Lisa Genova is the neuroscientist who wrote Still Alice, which was made into a movie starring Julianne Moore. It was about a woman who suffers early onset Alzheimer's disease. Now, Genova, she's written other books as well, but she has most recently written a guide called Remember, the Science of Memory, the Art of Forgetting. And here she is now. Hello.
Hello.
Tell me this, please. Is there any truth in the idea that as we age, our brains get full and consequently things overflow or get misplaced and lost?
That is absolutely not true.
Oh, rats.
No, so there's this misconception that, you know, you only use 10% of your brain, or that your memory bank can fill up and then you can't have any room for more memories. None of those are true. You use all of your brain potentially at any given moment. All of your brain is accessible to you, depending on what you're asking it to accomplish. And you have trillions of connections, and memory is a bunch of related connections, associated connections. And throughout your life, you have the possibility of remembering and learning new things forever, as long as you live.
But why do we forget things then? Why do we have what you've described as that TOT, the tip of the tongue experience?
Okay, so why does that happen? So most of what we humans forget every day is a normal part of being human. It is not a symptom of Alzheimer's disease or dementia. So when you experience a tip of the tongue, and, oh, what's his name? Or what's the name of that movie my friend recommended? This is normal. This is our brains have a very difficult time remembering proper nouns. So people's names, cities, movie titles, book titles, they sort of live in neurological cul-de-sacs, very difficult to ultimately get to, unlike common words that are sort of in Main Street and have tons of intersections and ways to get to them. So we experience, like 20-year-olds experience several tip of the tongues a day, but young people don't sweat them because Alzheimer's, old age, and memory loss aren't really on their radars. But as we get older, we notice them more, and then we start to freak out and worry that they're a symptom of something pathological, but they're actually just a byproduct of how our brains are designed.
So are you saying we don't actually forget those things more?
No, you might feel like they're happening more often, especially because, so as you age, processing speed slow. So you can kind of feel the, like, it takes you longer sometimes. So you're like, oh, I know his name. And it's like, oh, it hurts. Like, it's so hard to get it. And so when you're younger, the processing speeds are faster. And so you might get to it sooner. But no, it doesn't happen any more frequently necessarily. It's more noticeable more than anything. And I think that a lot of us have this, experience where, like, if we leave it alone for a while, it eventually bubbles to the surface later when you're not even trying.
Yeah. Why is that?
So it's so cool. So oftentimes what happens in your brain is when you can't come up with the right word, you've actually landed on a different word, usually something similar in sound or meaning, or it has the same first letter. And so in psychology, we call this the ugly sister of the target. And so your brain is focused on that ugly sister. It's in the wrong neural neighborhood. Once you've stopped trying to find it, the brain can stop perseverating on the ugly sister on the wrong part of town, giving the correct set of neurons a chance to be activated in the cul-de-sac, you know, in another part of your brain. So that's why that happens.
Do you have, though, Lisa, those conversations that go, I saw that movie the other day, you know, it's got, you know, in it, you know, she was in that, you know, that other movie that also had, oh, you know, thingy. And you go on and on, and then you start going through the alphabet for the original name. Do you do that?
I do. We all do that. We all do that. And so it's normal. And so, you know, people very much are worried about what's the distinction between normal forgetting and Alzheimer's. So it's, you know, the words that go missing. It's the, why did I walk in this room? It's, oh, where did I put my phone, my keys, my glasses? Where did I park my car? These are all normal. So the words that go missing, like if you start forgetting, like if you're starting to say, you know, the word, what the thing I use to write with, what's that called? Oh, the thing I write with, a pen? Like if words like pen or computer or hairbrush, if everyday common words, common nouns go missing, that could be something as a sign of something that you might want to ask your doctor about if that's happening frequently. But if it's frequently names, if it's frequently proper nouns, like his name, oh, the movie, oh, the book title, that's completely normal, not a sign of anything amiss. It's just the price of playing poker for being human. Like our memory system is not perfect. It is not designed to remember people's names, what to do later, or everything that you encounter.
If one has a bad memory, and many people do, you say the way to improve it is to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there are so many, there are so many distractions now that that becomes increasingly difficult.
Right. So this is, you know, one of the reasons that we feel foggy these days. It's like sort of a couple things contribute. So we are living such distracted lives. We, you know, we're in mid conversation, but someone texts us. So we stop what we're saying to look at our phones. And so the phones are a big distraction. Life is, you know, there's a lot going on. So the very first necessary step in creating a memory that's going to last longer than this present moment is attention. If you don't pay attention to something, you cannot form a memory of it. So if you, you know, if you're regularly like, oh, I can't remember where I put my glasses, or I'm always losing my phone, or I can't find my keys, I would actually bet that unless you've got Alzheimer's, that this is a symptom of distraction and not, it didn't even involve your memory because you didn't pay attention to where you put them in the first place. The other thing has to do with, you know, relative to the pandemic, where a lot of us have been socially isolated and the menu of possibilities for day-to-day life has shrunken to the confines of our homes. We remember what is meaningful, emotional, surprising, and new. Okay. And so things that are same old, routine, habitual, inconsequential, day-to-day, you know, same everyday stuff, our brains are not designed to remember that. So some of why we're feeling foggy these days has to do with lack of attention and also just the sameness of our day-to-day lives now. Like sameness is the kiss of death to memory. So if you want to remember more, get out of your routine, learn something new, be around something that's emotional, that wakes up your brain, something that's important to you, that's meaningful. That's the stuff you remember.
And if you want to remember things, you write them down, except that that can distort memory as well, can't it?
It can. It depends on the kind of memory you're talking about. So, for example, for folks who are always talking about like, oh, what's wrong with me? If I need to remember to do something later and I don't write it down, I'll forget it. So that must mean I'm getting Alzheimer's, right? Wrong. So your prospective memory, your memory for what you plan to do later, this is like your brain's to-do list for the future, is terrible in everyone. You should write it down. You should make the to-do list, put it in your calendar, put it in your phone. This is why airline pilots don't rely on their brains to remember to lower the wheels before they land the plane. They know not to rely on their prospective memory. So writing those kinds of to-do lists are good. But there are other kinds of memory. The one you're talking about is your memory for what happened. So your memory for what happened is organized in your brain differently than your memory for how to do things. So like how to ride a bike, how to type an email, how to swing a golf club, or the memory for stuff you know. So like, you know, who was the first president of your country or your birthday. So that's stuff you know. For stuff that happened, when you revisit it, it has the opportunity and is vulnerable to being changed. So I can add new things, subtract things. If someone else has an opinion, it might infiltrate its way in. If I have a new opinion, the memories for stuff that happened can be really influenced by all kinds of information that's new now. And then I'll restore that new memory and overwrite the old one. So if I live today and I keep a journal, say I keep a diary and I write down what happened today, I will only pick and choose certain things. And then when I go back and revisit this day, it's sort of influenced by what I wrote down and how I framed it. That's how I'll remember it going forward. So your memories for what happened can be a little funny. And this is why it's, you know, somewhat dangerous to rely on eyewitness testimony. You certainly wouldn't want to rely on that solely to convict someone or not. One of the great studies on this that I love that's so simple and quick to explain is, like, if I were to show you a video right now of a car crash and ask you, how fast were the cars going when they contacted each other? You might say, say you say 30 miles an hour. If I then instead asked you, how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? Or if I said crashed into each other, the substitution of that single verb will change your memory for of what you saw. And so you might say they were going 40 miles an hour. So the substitution of a single word can influence how we restore a memory of what happened.
So those would be classified as leading questions, depending on the verb that you chose to use, right?
Right. So they're called leading questions when we're talking about sort of, you know, a court case. But what happens in your day-to-day life when you're revisiting something that happened and you're sharing the story with a friend? Do you change the verb? Do they change the verb? Like, it's so easy for the memory of what happened to sort of migrate away from its original memory, sort of like that telephone game where, like, each time you tell it, it's slightly different. And then over time, it's not what it was originally.
Can we do something to improve our memories?
Absolutely. So if just overall, in terms of, you know, how strong and robust is your memory going to be today? And then how can you save the integrity of your memory over your lifespan, right? So that your brain span matches your lifespan. So in general, we want to get good sleep. And I think everybody knows this, right? Everybody knows, yeah, I'm supposed to get 7 to 9 hours a night. But why is that? With respect to memory, there are three things that folks should know. So the part of your brain that's responsible for taking what you've experienced and learned and converting it into a lasting memory that's going to last tomorrow, next week, next year, is the hippocampus. That's a part of your brain that's necessary for forming new memories. It does its job. It locks in those sights and sounds and emotions and smells and all of it. It does that while you sleep. So if you don't get a full night's sleep, your hippocampus might not have had enough time to do its job. And so those memories won't be fully formed. Another reason is that I already told you, you need attention to form new memories. Well, if you get a horrible night's sleep, you're going to wake up the next day exhausted and not, you know, you're dragging yourself around and you're not able to pay full attention today. And so if I can't pay good attention today, then I'm not going to be able to form memories well today. So it's really like almost a kind of amnesia you can experience if you've been sleep deprived. The last reason has to do with Alzheimer's. So one of the things that happens while we sleep, our brain, you know, we're not aware of it, but our brains are very biologically busy. And one of the things that's going on is your glial cells. These are the janitors of your brain. This is the sewage and sanitation department. They're cleaning up your brain while you're asleep. And one of the things that clears away is a protein called amyloid beta. And if amyloid beta is not cleared away, it sticks to itself and forms plaques. And if too many amyloid plaques form, that is the beginning of Alzheimer's. So if you don't get enough sleep, your glial cells won't have enough time to clear away the amyloid and you'll start to pile that up.
Oh, God, so that's going to keep me awake tonight.
Oh, so the opposite is like, so here's the deal. Like, I know, because this can stress people out, because I know a lot of us aren't. Time and stress is, being chronically stressed is not good for memory. I'm 50 and it's like I'm starting to go through menopause and my sleep is being disrupted. So rather than everyone freaking out, it's like, here's a way to frame it. Every night is a new chance to potentially do something really good for your brain and your memory. And there are lots of tips on how to sleep better. So everyone can Google a guy named Matthew Walker. He's got a great TED Talk on sleep. He also has a book on sleep. But there's so many tips, including, like, you know, caffeine is really great for memory. So caffeine increases your attention, and attention helps you form new memories. But it also will keep you awake. So you, and the half-life of caffeine is 5 hours, which means you'll still have half the amount of dose in the original latte or you know, whatever your coffee or your tea 5 hours later. So if you have an espresso at 7 p.m., you still have a significant amount of caffeine in your brain buzzing around at midnight. So you want to be careful of when you have that last, you know, cup of tea in the day or a cup of coffee. You need to lower your body temperature by 2 degrees to fall asleep. So make sure your room's not too hot. There's so many tips. You can Google this, but make it a priority because sleep, if you want a good memory today and tomorrow, getting a good night's sleep is super important to help you. Chronic stress. You want to decrease stress, folks. And like, I know our world is super stressful right now. Stress is really bad for your memory. So, you know, things like yoga and meditation, mindfulness, exercise, all of those are really powerful stress busters and have been shown to help improve your memory.
You know, though, that of three people, one of us is going to get Alzheimer's, right? So is it inevitable? Yeah.
It's not inevitable. So right now, the statistics are at the age of 85, 1 in 3 people will have Alzheimer's. And it's fast approaching 1 in 2. And this is quite alarming because if you think about it also, you know, so 1 in 2 will get Alzheimer's, but then who's the caregiver? So it's really going to affect all of us. But that's the statistic now. And I think that, you know, 10, 20 years ago, for sure, people weren't talking about Alzheimer's. We had our heads in the sand over it. You know, it was so taboo and shameful and so much stigma attached that nobody was talking about it. Now, at least we're in conversation about this and we can openly talk about what we can do to prevent it. And so, you know, people tend to have the sense that, or the misconception that there's nothing you can do about your health from the neck up. We're super comfortable with the idea of influencing our heart health, right? So we have the sense that, well, if I walk a certain number of steps and eat a heart-healthy diet and go to the doctor and get my blood pressure checked, I can stay involved in my heart health and prevent having a heart attack someday. Well, similarly, we can actually do the same for Alzheimer's. The science and the data are really clear and compelling. So exercise, regular aerobic exercise, a daily brisk walk, can reduce your risk of Alzheimer's by up to 50%. That's significant, right? If you had a pill that did that, you'd take it. So sleep is also, you know, getting good sleep will reduce your risk of Alzheimer's. It's not inevitable. So lowering stress, staying socially and mentally active. So this does not mean doing crossword puzzles. This does not mean doing brain games.
Why not?
Because it's doing crossword puzzles is basically just retrieving information you already know. And doing brain games is you're going to get really good at that game. But it then doesn't translate into there's not enough rich encoding. You're not, when you learn new things, you're building new neural connections. You're actually building a bigger brain. You'll have more neural roads to travel should some of them become blocked with Alzheimer's. When you're socially in touch with people, conversation, listening to this conversation with you and me right now, this is helping people are, if you're listening, you're learning. Your brain is very active right now, building pathways. You're learning information. When you're around people, you're also not socially isolated. And social isolation has been shown to be bad for our memories and bad for our brains and may increase our risk of Alzheimer's. We don't necessarily understand all of like the molecular neurobiology as to why, but we know from correlational longitudinal studies that these things have a significant impact. So just like we do with our hearts, we know that we can do something to prevent heart disease, to lower our risk of dying from a heart attack. There are things we can do to lower our risk of developing Alzheimer's. So Mediterranean diet, exercise, sleep, lower stress, and stay cognitively active. Learn new things, like learn a new instrument, a new language. Go for a walk in a different neighborhood. Cook a new recipe. Read a book and then talk about it with people. It will keep your brain alert and active in creating new neural pathways that will make your brain resistant to being impacted by Alzheimer's.
And yet, There's no data to support the idea that staying cognitively active in that way will prevent the normal changes in memory due to aging.
No. And so I talk about this in my book, too, because it's like, you know, everyone would like to say there's something we can do to never age. And it's like, well, just like your skin, right? So your brain is an organ. It's tissue in your body, just like, you know, your skin is an organ. And so I can wear sunscreen and stay out of the sun and eat healthy food. And my skin might look good for my age, but my skin at 50 is not going to look like my skin did at when it was 20. So you can absolutely take care of yourself. And I recommend this, right? So we do what you can to take care of the health of your brain and the health of your memory. And at 70, it will not be as quick as it was when you were 20. That said, like I talk about a man, a retired engineer from Japan, who at the age of 69, an age that we associated with being retired and senior discounts, he memorized pi, a non-repeating number with no pattern, to over 100,000 digits. So he memorized over 100,000 digits of pi. Like, that seems impossible to me. And he did this at an age that, you know, he's not young. But that said, if he had tried to do that at 29, he probably would have been able to memorize more. So we age. There's no rabbit out of a hat or magic pill I can give you for that.
Here's the question about Mr. Haraguchi, who remembered all those pi numbers.
Yeah.
Did that exercise improve his brain? And if not, why bother?
Well, right. So I don't like, if you're just trying to improve your memory for your day-to-day life and you want to get better at your, you know, your Zoom presentations, or you want to remember more of the book you read, you want to remember where you put your glasses, you don't need to do what Haraguchi did. These memory athletes, these memory champions are training themselves in a very specific way to remember vast strings of numbers, or they can memorize, you know, they can memorize a deck of cards in 60 seconds. That doesn't really translate to everyday life. So he is using his brain, and the way these athletes do that is they don't just rotely memorize the order of the numbers. They memorize a schema, a trick for, like, these numbers translate to words that create a story, or these numbers translate to images that I can then put into a story. So stories are easier for us to remember because they have meaning, right? I told you that our brains remember what is meaningful, what is emotional, what is surprising. So they'll translate those numbers into, like, they're almost symbols for something really, some emotional image or some shocking image. And they'll string those together to tell themselves a story. So Haraguchi can memorize 100,000 digits of pi, but he can also forget his wife's birthday, which he did, or why he walked into his living room. So it's not a panacea. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to have memory superpowers across the board.
People with highly superior autobiographical memory, or HSAM, can recall details of every day of their lives, or their conscious lives. I mean, after the age of 5 or something, I don't know. How and why?
Yeah, so this is fascinating. And so for this book, I talked with Mary Lou Henner, a U.S. actress who is in Taxi, because she's one of the 100 or so people on the planet who've been identified as having highly superior autobiographical memory. We don't exactly know how they do it. We've identified through brain scans 9 regions of the brain in these folks, which are enlarged compared to us normal people who cannot remember in detail the stuff that happened throughout our lives. We don't know, though, if those regions are enlarged and then cause them to have this memory superpower, or if having this memory superpower causes these areas to become enlarged. It's sort of a chicken and egg thing. But these folks are amazing. So if you say to Mary Lou, okay, Mary Lou, what happened on April 9th, 1982? she would say, okay, that was a Monday and it was sunny and, oh, we were filming this episode of Taxi and then I drove with Johnny Travolta to San Francisco. Like, she'd give me the whole day. I was wearing these shoes. She can do that. And she sometimes comes up with the news event that was happening on that day too. If I happened to pick one, she'd say, oh, the LA riots were that day. So she can do this for any day, you know, of her life since about the age of 10. And we don't know how these folks do it, but it has something to do with how their brains are organizing things by time. So she always comes up with the day of the week first. And it's not a trick. Like, she's not playing some kind of calendar game. This isn't some sort of autistic sort of, you know, special talent in that way. It's just her brain remembers the stuff that happened. So episodic memory, unlike ours. So we don't. Most people remember a total of 8 to 10 days per year with specific vivid detail. The rest of the days we forget. And again, because what did you do most days? You brushed your teeth, you took a shower, you drank the coffee, you ate the meals, you looked at the screens, you texted a few people, and you went to bed day after day after day. And we don't remember that stuff. We remember what's emotional, surprising, meaningful, new.
But do we remember it accurately, having already spoken about the dodginess of eyewitness reports? Is Mary Lou remembering things accurately?
Not the stuff that happened. Like, so, you know, I forgive me for giving U.S. examples, but like in the U.S., like if I, as a kid, we all memorized George Washington was the first president of the United States. I can repeat that a million times. It's never going to change to Abraham Lincoln was the first president of the United States. But for stuff that happened, it can change. And we're not necessarily aware of it. So we all have... there are these kinds of memories called flashbulb memories, which is a little bit of a misnomer because they're not photographic in any way, but they feel very vividly remembered years later. These are memories for something that happened. We share a lot of public ones. So they're for something that happened that was shocking and emotional and felt a personal, you know, a personal connection to it in some way. So for in the United States, it's, you know, it's usually you remember where you were, what you were doing, who you were with, the time of day when this thing happened. So the examples in the U.S. are, where were you when President Kennedy was shot? Or where were you when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up? Or when the Twin Towers collapsed on September 11th, 2001? So we remember these things, and we, because they feel so vividly and confidently remembered, we think they're accurate. But this is a memory for something that happened, and so it's really not. And my favorite study on this was out of Emory College in the United States. These psychology professors interviewed Psych 101 students. So these are 19 and 20-year-olds, right? So these are young brains, people with young brains. They interviewed these students 24 hours after the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up, asked them, who were you with? Where were you? What were you doing? How did you feel? What time of day was it? Ask them these questions. 2.5 years later, they had the students back in, gave them the same questionnaire again. 75% of the students didn't even remember taking that test. All of the students, 100% of them. So none of them answered questions that were exactly the same as they did 2.5 years ago. So none of their answers matched entirely. I'm not saying that well. But so no one remembered it exactly the same.
Right.
And then the most astounding part of this is when shown their original answers in their own handwriting, they were so befuddled by this. They couldn't make sense of it. They were like, well, that doesn't, I don't know where you, I don't know why that would be that way. This is how I remember it now.
I've had a number of people saying, given the importance of sleep and the prevalence of insomnia, would you recommend taking sleeping medication in order to get that vital sleep?
No. The problem with sleep medication is that it's you know, well, there's lots of problems with it. I mean, some of them are addictive. Some of them actually, you're not getting the quality sleep that you need. So when you're sleeping, again, it's not just an unconscious state of nothingness. You're very biologically busy, and there are very specific stages of sleep that you need. And some of those medications, you're not getting the full cycles of sleep that you need. So no, as of now, I don't know of any of the pharmaceutical sleep aids that are could be recommended for quality sleep. But there are things that you can do with respect to melatonin. There's a timing of when that your melatonin level should be high, and you could supplement with that. I would, again, talk with your doctor, who would know exactly when that is good for you to take. You got to be mindful of caffeine, because that will compete with adenosine and keep you awake. So alcohol also is one that you got to be careful of. So alcohol will decrease both the quantity and the quality of your sleep.
I've received a question saying, does alcohol damage our brains? And certainly in terms of its effect on sleep, it would be damaging. Are there other contraindications for alcohol in terms of memory?
Well, yes. So, I mean, in excess, I mean, this is especially problematic for young people, especially in universities. Like, if you drink to excess, if your alcohol levels go up enough, you will essentially shut down your hippocampus. And this is why people black out. This is why people can be conscious walking around, but they have absolutely no memory of what they're doing and won't ever, because the hippocampus is basically offline now and can't form any new memories. So that can happen. I should also mention that there's sort of this urban myth out there that red wine will prevent you from getting Alzheimer's. And that's like, there's no data to support that. I'm so sorry. I know a lot of you are hoping that, like, oh, my glass of red wine every night is going to prevent Alzheimer's, but it doesn't. The resveratrol, the ingredient in red wine that has antioxidant properties, all of the studies that have been done, first of all, have been done in mice. They haven't shown any cognitive improvement, and the amount of resveratrol that they've put in these mice to show, to see if it, you know, decreases amyloid beta, prevents Alzheimer's pathology in the brain. The amount you'd have in the equivalent amount of wine, you'd have to have like 60 glasses of wine to even have the same dosage of resveratrol. So it's just not true.
It's interesting, isn't it? We're constantly on the search for the fountain of youth. But when it comes down to it, based on what you're saying, it comes down to things as simple as sleep, diet, and exercise.
I know. And it's not very sexy. I know we live in an age where it's like, you know, we want something like really cool and high tech. And it's, you know, it almost doesn't surprise me though, right? Like, it's our brains and bodies are designed to work if we give it the right fuel and the right nourishment.
Let me ask you this finally. There's so much to talk about and we're nearly out of time. But if you've got that tip of the tongue thing going on,
yeah,
is it better to force your brain to think about it or stop thinking about it and then arrive at it? Does using Google make your brain lazy?
I'm so glad you asked this, because this is another myth. No. So people are so afraid of using Google because they think it's cheating, or they think that they're going to weaken their already worsening memory if they look it up. They're going to get digital amnesia. None of that is true, especially for tip of the tongue. So, you know, again, tip of the tongue is a normal glitch in memory retrieval, just a byproduct of how our brains are designed. You do not make your memory stronger by suffering through the tip of the tongue and coming up with it on your own. You do not make your memory weaker by Googling it and looking it up. So if I can't come up with the name of the actor who played Tony Soprano, I'm like, oh, what's his name? I do not, if I insist on coming up with that on my own, that doesn't mean that I'm, you know, not going to forget where I put my glasses, or my memory's not going to be stronger and better for memorizing my Zoom presentation. It's doesn't cross over like that. So good, look it up, people. You have my permission. Like, you wear glasses if your eyes need help seeing. Your brain needs help with pronouns. So if you get a word stuck on the tip of your tongue, you can look it up. And by the way, young people, another reason they don't notice this is because they've been tethered to smartphones since practically birth. So if they have a word stuck on the tip of their tongue, they don't hesitate in outsourcing the job. Unlike their parents who like insist on suffering and coming up with it on our own. You don't have to do that. You can look it up.
Very good. Thank you. It's been excellent talking to you. Thank you for giving us so much time. That was, you know, thingy. What's her name? Lisa Genova, who wrote a book called Remember, the Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting.